Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Dry Dock, episode 406. This week, the questions are taken from guides 475 and 476 on the Ibuki-class armored cruisers and the Russian armored cruiser Rurik, the Wednesday videos on overgunned warships for fun and profit, and should Admiral Troubridge have engaged Admiral Souchon and the Goeben with his armored cruisers, and finally, the Friday video on HMS Speedy versus El Gamo under Captain Cochrane. Warrant Officer 2528 asks, who was the most powerful navy left out of the Washington Naval Treaty? Purely on paper strength, probably the Russians. Although in the early 1920s, with the complete and utter chaos that was Russia in the aftermath of the Bolshevik Revolution, the practical strength of the Russian fleet at that point was negligible. But of course, you could theoretically look into the future and say, well, what if they actually got all the ships they technically own working, then they would be, you know, the most powerful non-treaty fleet of the period based on what they had in 1921-22. If you want to look at the most powerful fleet that, you know, could actually sail out of its own harbour and do something, probably technically the Chileans, I would imagine. The Brazilians were in the middle of something of an economic downturn. Their navy wasn't really that functional in the early 20s. And although the Argentinians obviously have the two Rivadavias, the Chileans only have Almirante Latorre. Latorre is more powerful than an individual Rivadavia, and it's only just been transferred back from being HMS Canada in the Royal Navy, so it is fully operational. And Chile has a number of other, for the time, relatively modern naval units to hand. Whereas in the early 20s, somewhat like Brazil, Argentina is going through a bit of an economic downturn, and the Rivadavias are not in the best of condition, and they're actually about to go into reserve. So yeah, the Chilean Navy is probably the most powerful functional navy, not in the Washington Naval Treaty. The man formerly known as Commenting Is What I Do asks, back in Dry Dock 282, you answered my question about who would get the most out of making certain battleships with a triple turret arrangement. And your answer was the Queen Elizabeth's, mentioning that Hood would likely get triples anyway in that scenario. However, I'm curious as to what impact the Queen Elizabeth's being triple turret designs would have had on the Revenge class or Renown and Repulse. Would either of those designs have gone back to twin turrets, either at all or potentially with a super firing spot twin like with the Nevadas? Or would the R class lose a turret? And between Renown and Repulse, would having triples on the R's make them with triples fore and aft, what would be the biggest benefit to the ships in question? Well, this is actually the starting point for one of my theoretical timelines, which I've mentioned once or twice on the channel, which I tentatively call the all-forward British timeline. And so this is the all-forward Hood, for example. So essentially the argument goes that, at least in this timeline, so this is what I would be suggesting as a potential impact, is the Queen Elizabeth's, instead of having four twin 15-inch guns, they decide, well, you know what, if we're going for fast battleships and 15-inch guns, we might as well go the whole hog with innovative stuff, so we're going to go with triple turrets as well. And that actually does make a certain amount of sense, because while they are technically more complex, having three triple turrets actually takes up slightly less volume and slightly less length than having four twins, and it gets you an extra gun into the bargain. And when you're looking at something like the Queen Elizabeth, where you want them to be relatively high speed, well, that little bit of extra space saving gives you space for more boilers and therefore more power, so you can go faster, which is obviously a good thing. So those ships then would be built with, you know, super firing triples forward, one triple aft, very 1930s-1940s style. But then when they come to the Revenge class and they go, okay, well, we want Queen Elizabeth but cheaper and more fleet battle line like, which is essentially what the Revenges are, then they go, oh, okay, so we like the space and savings and potential weight savings of this triple turret layout, but we need to find a lot of weight savings here. What can we do? And this spawns an idea of, well, we can keep the armament, but if we move it all forward, aka Nelson or F3 style, then we massively shorten the Citadel. And since we want to shorten up the engineering spaces anyway, because we want them to be somewhat slower, we shorten the ship up even more. And thus we save a huge amount of weight, space, and money. So the Revenges end up being the first all-forward battleships in the Royal Navy with 9 15-inch guns and 3 triple turrets. Whether you want Nelson style like here or F3 style, it's kind of up to you. And then when they come to doing the armored cruisers, they go, okay, well, we can lose a turret. We have 6 guns. That, you know, is still a respectable arm. That's what they chose for renown and repulse historically, just in 3 twins. And so you end up with almost a mini Richelieu, where obviously Richelieu has a super firing pair of quadruple 15s. In this case, it would be a super firing pair of triple 15s. And then, of course, again, you've saved a ton of weight and space. You can put into a lot of machinery, so you can go really fast, thus battlecruiser. And then when they come to designing Hood, they're like, ah, well, 3 triple 15s worked for battleships, 2 triple 15s worked for renown and repulse for going quickly. Now we want battleship armament and armor, but going quickly. So in this particular timeline, obviously, they went with the Nelson layout, and they just go, okay, well, we'll add that third triple turret back in again, except really long hull, and now the thing can move really quickly, and it has battleship-style firepower as well as battleship-style protection. And as you can see, most of the secondary battery is just loosely scattered aft. Although I suspect there probably would be a gun gallery in the original version of Hood along the center as well. It's just I threw this together as I was throwing together a whole ton of different designs at that point. Danny Elkins asks, you mentioned that Ibuki had her turbine engines installed after her launch. Besides the watertight hull, is there a typical build point for launching, or does it vary by Navy and time frame? I could see perhaps wartime necessity causing earlier launches and peacetime ones focusing on efficiency. It does vary somewhat by both Navy and time frame, partly for some of the reasons you listed. In wartime, when you need to just build ships as quickly as possible, you kind of throw them off the slipway essentially as soon as practically possible, as long as doing so isn't going to extend the build time elsewhere. So, for example, if there's something you could install while it's on the slipway that will take you an additional week, but chucking off the slipway that week early, you could do it during the fitting out stage, but it'll take you 3, it's probably worth keeping the slipway, you know, occupied for another week to do so. But once you get beyond that, there's a huge number of variables in play, some of which will be environmental. So how big is the area of water into which you're launching a ship? Because that will affect on how heavy the ship can be. And essentially it comes down to weight, because the heavier a ship is, the faster it's going to go down that slipway, and the further it's going to go out into the water, the more energy it's going to have. And the angle of the slipway can make a difference as well, because obviously more weight on a steep slipway, there's going to be a huge amount of stress on the ship. Obviously, if it's lighter, that's better. And also the just overall, not just the proportional weight of the ship, but the overall weight of the ship. So when you look at pre-dreadnought launches, for example, very often they have their casemates and a decent chunk of their superstructure actually already constructed when they're launched. Not all of them, but a lot of them. And then when you look at dreadnought and super dreadnought launches like Iron Duke here, apart from usually maybe some of the barbettes, they're basically flush decked. Again, for the most part. Ideally, most navies liked to have the engines and the boilers in place before the ship launched, partly because that provided a lot of low down weight, which made the ship stable, because obviously if it's very light, it's going to be riding high. So to avoid capsize, you want weight lower down in the ship. But it also meant you could close in a lot of the decks, including potentially the deck armor, although whether you put the armor plates in or not did vary, but usually you'd have to, because if you want to complete the ship up to main deck level, the deck armor had to go in because it was several decks down. You could, of course, leave big holes where you could drop machinery in later on, especially if you don't have some of the machinery ready in time, like with Ibuki. But generally, you would want the machinery in there for the reasons I just mentioned. One of the other things that varies quite considerably, both by time and by Navy, is whether or not the main armor is installed. as you can see here with Iron Duke, her main armor isn't there. There's a little void spaces where all that armor plate is going to be, because again, this is going to add a huge amount of weight and stress to the ship on launch. And to be honest, installing the armor plate when she's riding so high without her armament, a lot of her interior fittings and the superstructure on, is a fairly easy job to do at the fitting out pier. But sometimes you'll see navies launch the ship with its armor in place, sometimes because they've got a relatively shallow slipway or they've got plenty of space in the river or the estuary or wherever they're launching it for the ship to run on. Sometimes it's a limitation of the ship design. So, for example, the Iowas launch with their armor in place because their armor is internal to the ship. And if you don't install that, you can't install the exterior hull plating, and, well, that's a major problem. And we've mostly focused on battleships here, but, you know, if you're launching something like, say, a small cruiser by World War I or World War II, you might as well stick the armor on while the ship's being built on the slipway, because that armor is, of course, thinner as an absolute factor, and also the ship being somewhat smaller, the armor just isn't going to cover as large an area. Therefore, proportionally, the armor doesn't exert anywhere near as much stress as battleship armor would. So you see the launch of various, say, Dido class light cruisers. Very often they do have their armor in place. But even by World War II, even with ships of a roughly cruiser displacement, if you have a very narrow, confined area where the ship's actually going to run out to, you will sometimes see the hull being launched as light as humanly possible, just so that they can catch it and redirect it without it running aground on the opposite bank. Redasaurus asks, in one of your worst warship design videos, you had the Sovetsky Soyuz class down there due to its planned armor being of low quality. My question is, couldn't Stalin have brought in ship armor makers from other countries to show them how to make good armor, like he did with American workers to make cars during the Great Depression? Theoretically, but there are a couple of key differences. Firstly, it's one thing to go, the capitalist pigs have managed to work out how to build cars very efficiently while we were in the middle of our glorious revolution to free ourselves from our imperialist overlords, and therefore we are going to exploit their knowledge by getting them over, and then the silly capitalists will tell us how to do everything, and then we will clearly improve on it and do it better, which was essentially the propaganda line internally for the car worker bit, versus the state cannot actually build something on a par with, well, what everybody else has been able to do for 10, 15, 20 years and actually safeguard the motherland. And so we need to bring in said foreign capitalist pig experts to tell us how to do it. We can't possibly admit that we suck at warship building now, because we, you know, executed or gulagged everybody who knew what they were doing in the Soviet Union. It's kind of like these days, you know, a lot of countries will go over to some foreign car company and go, hey, well, do you want to come build a production line in our country so that you can sell more cars slightly cheaper in our country? And then we get the, you know, the positive PR of having jobs created in our country, and perhaps your shipping cost to other nearby countries will go down. Whereas most nations don't turn around and go, we don't know how to build submarines. Can you come and help us? Because just admitting it is a massive national security issue. And that's without the politics of Soviet Russia, where everything Soviet is clearly better than everything else, except when it isn't. And then we just easily copy whatever the silly capitalists have come up with. That's not to say some nations haven't, you know, quietly gone under the table to try and figure out how to build submarines again, but generally speaking, they wouldn't want to admit to it, in at least in public. Same thing with things like aircraft carriers. But there is another factor, which is that, well, this at the time was pretty much top level military technology, and post 1920, various nations had diverged quite considerably. So before the war, before World War One, that is, the standard of Krupp steel, the material composition, the depth of face hardening, while there was a certain degree of national variation, it wasn't huge. during the interwar period, it diverged considerably more, and people were becoming a lot more secretive about exactly how they made their armor. And so if the Soviets turned around and said, hey, do you want to tell us all the secrets about how to make ship armor? The vast majority of nations, just on principle, would have laughed them out the door before you get to the whole fact that they are the Soviets. So, you know, the Americans and the British, etc., would be laughing them out the door on ideological grounds, completely aside from national security grounds. And the people who might have been willing to sell them the expertise, and indeed were willing to sell them a lot of naval technology and designs, namely the Italians and the Germans, well, their armor industries weren't that large to begin with, so they couldn't necessarily have afforded to send a large delegation of their own naval armor making experts over without perhaps critically impacting their own production. And even if they did, or even if they could afford to do so from a financial perspective, they are still competitors with Soviet Russia. And whether they'd want Soviet Russia to be able to make battleship armor properly is a whole other question. They probably wouldn't, and therefore they would just refuse or come up with some excuse why they wouldn't do so. If they had a little bit of spare production capacity, they might happily sell the Russians a little bit of armor. But obviously, if you're selling them armor, you're not teaching them how to produce it, and you can cut the supply off if you get a bit nervous about how they're using it. Then we have, I recently stumbled across a piece talking about the German defenses of Guernsey. Now, typical of late-night docudramas, it portrayed Guernsey as an impregnable death trap whose only flaw was that the Allies didn't actually try and take it. Putting aside all the Werribee hype, how would you actually rank Guernsey's defences, particularly in comparison to the Atlantic Wall, both at its strongest points and in places like Normandy? And do Guernsey's fortifications actually live up to the hype? Now, I haven't visited Guernsey myself. I have visited Jersey, the other one of the big Channel Islands, and obviously that was fortified in a very similar manner. As you can see here, this is a rangefinder on one of the bunkers. So, looking at the on-paper stats of the defences in Guernsey and drawing parallels to what they were doing in Jersey, it simultaneously was very, very heavily fortified, but also it's definitely not impregnable. So there were a lot of guns, a lot of heavy guns, especially on Guernsey in particular. The heaviest guns were a bunch of 12-inch Russian battleship guns, or ex-battleship guns. But that kind of also reveals one of the bigger weaknesses of the project, the Channel Islands fortification generally, which was that they were throwing everything and the kitchen sink from an extremely random pile of weaponry. So you had World War One and even pre-Dreadnought era French guns, World War One and post-World War One era Russian guns, some older pre-Dreadnought and World War One era German guns, a few captured Czech guns, and kind of the list goes on. So there was no standardization really in the defenses. So you couldn't have a case of, well, okay, this particular set of bunkers, perhaps with 150mm guns, is under attack, and an Allied bomber has managed to either collapse the access tunnels to or actually blow up the main magazine, so we don't have any ammunition, but overnight we can perhaps ship some ammunition in from the bunker a couple of miles down the road, because that also has 150mm ammo. It would be a case of, well, we've got 194mm French ammunition for our 194mm French guns. That magazine is gone. That we're the only bunker on the island with this particular kind of gun. And yes, there is another bunker up the road, but that's got 203mm Russian ammo. And the bunker 6 miles that way has 203mm ammo, but that's 203mm German ammo. It's not compatible with the Russian, and we don't have 203mm guns here anyway, and so on and so forth. Now, they obviously have a lot of flak batteries, tunnels, bunkers, etc., etc., all designed to resist assault. However, the main strength of the Channel Islands defences rested more so on the fact they were just incredibly heavily garrisoned, both given the population and given the size of the islands. So we're talking 12,000-13,000 German troops per island when, you know, they basically outnumbered the local population taken in total. So you're talking about man per square mile levels in terms of troops, that exceed actually quite a number of Japanese-held islands that caused huge problems for the US in the Pacific. So, for example, there's more, if I'm getting my calculations right, there's more men per square mile on the Channel Islands than there were at Tarawa, for example. Iwo Jima does have more men per square mile by a considerable margin, but Iwo Jima is an absolute hellhole for attacking, as obviously the US experienced. And as far as I'm aware, Iwo Jima's defenses didn't have quite the same level of heavy artillery that the Germans put in on Jersey and Guernsey. They are also, of course, not atolls or anything like that, so they do have quite varied terrain, including a bunch of cliffs. So attacking them would be quite difficult, objectively speaking, and with those flak batteries protecting the anti-surface batteries, it would be quite difficult to take them out. However, with all that said, while they are a very tough nut to crack, and that's pretty much why the Allies kind of looked at them and went, what do we gain by taking them? What will we be losing by taking them? Right, it's just not worth it. We're just going to bypass them and we'll collect them as a surrender at the end of the war, which is historically what happened. If there had been something of great strategic value in actually having Guernsey and Jersey back in Allied hands, it could have been done, but it would have been quite a multi-layered operation. So, for example, one of the heavy gun batteries on Guernsey actually got taken out for a while by HMS Rodney, and here the terrain actually worked against them because Rodney fired over the land to drop shells on the exposed gun batteries while the gun batteries couldn't return fire, which, if you're looking at more Pacific-style, atoll-style fighting, that's not really a thing. So you would have needed a multi-layered bombardment. So you probably would have had heavy naval bombardment targeting the more exposed gun batteries, flak batteries, heavy anti-surface batteries, etc. Once the open flak batteries have been at least somewhat suppressed, you would then probably go in with pinpoint bomber attacks because you've got such a high level of civilian population in the area. You don't want to do carpet bombing, but I could, for example, see the Allies just going, okay, well, we've got these grand slams and tall boys. Why, once we've suppressed the heavy flak, why don't we just take out individual bunker nests with single or multiple tall boy or grand slam hits? Because they're fairly accurate weapons. For the most part, the major defences are clear of the civilian population centres, at least in terms of the blast radius of weapons like that. And it would blow open chunks of the island's defences. One of the things with the islands being relatively small is that each of the bunker networks themselves is also relatively small. They're tough nuts to crack, but they're not massive multi-mile sprawling fortresses. And of course, you could also go for covert commando insertion to open up certain beaches once some major cracks in the defences had been made. And indeed, there were a few commando raids on the Channel Islands that went off relatively well. But it would be, as I said, a very complex, multi-layered operation. It could be done, but it would be costly relative to the gain. Antonius Pius asks, you mentioned that HMS Drudge, if it was sunk in shallow water and settled, could continue to operate its gun in defence of a port. Yamato also thought if it could beach itself and continue to fight, it could likewise be a very tough nut to crack. Is there any instance where this kind of thing actually happened, a ship being sunk or beached and continuing to fight on, and then that was actually decisive or at least contributed significantly to the successful outcome of a battle or a defence? There were certainly multiple cases of ships ending up on the bottom but still able to fight and contributing to a defence. Whether it was successful or not is somewhat more variable. Canopus famously put herself aground and then engaged briefly with Admiral Spee's units as they approached the Falkland Islands, which contributed quite heavily to Spee deciding to break off his attack. Obviously, the sight of battle cruisers helped with that, but that is a case of a beach ship successfully engaging and contributing to a successful defence of a place. Not necessarily quite as successful, but a number of German warships at the end of World War II were hit by Allied bombing while in harbour. Now, some of them, like the Admiral Scheer, capsized. Others, while they were badly damaged and settled, did manage to settle vaguely upright. and some of them were then subsequently used as essentially gun batteries, heavy artillery batteries, to try and fight off the Soviet advance. Obviously, it didn't work, but it certainly helped the Germans to a certain degree. And in a similar manner, some of the Soviet warships that were sunk in Leningrad also functioned to a certain degree as floating either artillery or anti-aircraft or both batteries to help resist the German assaults. Also, while it wasn't technically a fully successful defence, the Danish defence against Admiral Nelson's attack at Copenhagen was helped quite considerably by the fact that a number of their ships and floating batteries were, again, in relatively shallow water. So even when badly damaged, they weren't at risk of sinking, which obviously encouraged their crews to fight on considerably more. And in a slight twist on that, I suppose, the Japanese were known during the Pacific campaign for occupying various sunken hulks of ships that had tried to supply their islands and obviously been hit by US forces earlier, with essentially holdout parties. And the idea there was not to necessarily afford direct resistance immediately, but to allow the US to establish their beachhead, which essentially pins the US forces in place. So there are now troops physically on the shore, and they have to be supplied. So there is now a kind of a fixed corridor of men and supplies and equipment going to them, where if it gets cut off, obviously the more conventional defenders on the island will be able to inflict heavy casualties on the attackers, possibly even throw them back. And what they'd do is they'd wait, and then once all of this was set up, then they would appear from the bowels of this sunken merchant ship or whatever and open fire with various weapons, you know, rifles, machine guns, mortars, etc., etc., and cause a fair bit of damage. And they were actually surprisingly difficult to dislodge. Obviously, it wasn't a successful defense in that it stopped the American assault, but it certainly caused an awful lot of problems. And it was actually one of the more major sticking points in the Makin Island campaign, which otherwise, especially in comparison to what was going on slightly further south, was a relatively successful and quote-unquote easy campaign. Random Warehouse asks, what would the ideal navy have been for Germany going into World War II in terms of role, layout, type and design of ships, etc.? That is, assuming the ideological factors that led to unrealistic projects were limited, but not, say, the economic and resource factors. How could they have concealed this build-up and the ship's purpose to prevent, say, more anti-submarine vessels from being built to counter more submarines? I'm working on an alternate history project where Germany has somewhat different institutional, cultural, and ideological motivations, so I'd really appreciate the help. Operating within the scope of vaguely realistic economic and resource factors, it really, really comes down to what is Germany expecting to fight? The Kriegsmarine, for the majority of its existence as the Kriegsmarine, once it took over from being the Reichsmarine, was geared around a naval fight that essentially involved fighting the Marine Nationale. And to a certain extent, the Kriegsmarine of 1939-1940 was not too badly set up to do that in terms of both numbers and the type of vessels they had. The problem they essentially had is that the navy that you build to fight the Marine Nationale in the 1930s and the navy you try and build if you're going to be fighting the Royal Navy in the 1930s are two incredibly different things. And they had to pivot at almost the last minute to try and look at fighting the much bigger Royal Navy. Hence why you got things like Plan Z and kind of being caught a little bit in between the two and, of course, having the infrastructure and economic limitations, they ended up with a navy that was initially fighting both the Marine Nationale and the Royal Navy and was no longer particularly well configured to fight either of them. So if we're going, as we said, with realistic economic and resource factors, I personally, there are a few different ways I could approach this, but personally, one way I would approach this would be to look at the situation and go, look, we can't fight the Royal Navy. Realistically, you know, we can't build the ships in the numbers that we need. We can't build the ships of, you know, a Yamato style size to try and fight the Royal Navy on an outnumbered but qualitatively even footing. All it's going to do is grind our fleet down. Therefore, if doing so is just going to grind our fleet down to not a particularly great end, we abandon that idea entirely and go off on a completely different tangent. So rather than trying to confront the Royal Navy head on, we build a navy that still, if we by luck happen to end up fighting just the Marine Nationale, can fight them, but also could present a very outsized threat to the Royal Navy without them necessarily catching on or being able to easily counter us. So in that vein, capital ship-wise, I would, probably unsurprising to many of you, have built the Scharnhorst with twin 15-inch guns to begin with and just keep building them. Because twin 15-inch armed Scharnhorsts are more than capable of going toe-to-toe with Dunkirk and Strasbourg. You know, there'd be strengths and weaknesses, especially fighting Strasbourg, but they would be perfectly fine doing so. And even though they would be notionally 1v1 somewhat limited against something like a Richelieu, if you've just been producing them, you are actually going to have more capital ships in service than the French by 1939-1940, and thus, or at least modern capital ships, and thus, hopefully, you can take out or badly damage one or two of their modern capital ships before they start bringing Richelieu and Jean Bart online, which maintains your numerical superiority, which then obviously will allow you to can at least have an even playing field, if not an upper hand. And such ships are, you know, relatively plausible threats to the older British battleships, but they're not quite of the size and scope that the British can point to them and say, oh, well, the King George V and the Lions would have a problem if these things showed up. And so it kind of mitigates the British ability to respond by pointing at the Germans going, look, threat, we must counter threat. If they are going to do so, they're going to have to either point to someone else like Japan, or they're going to have to be a little bit more aggressive in their justifications. From a submarine perspective, the main thing I would do would actually just be to prototype block production. So essentially kind of what they were trying to do with the Type 21s and Type 23s at the end of the war, try and get that system working before the war. So don't build up your submarine numbers too much, but also make a big song and dance about using almost all of your existing U-boat fleet as training craft and say, look, yes, we know we have U-boats, but we're using them mostly as training vessels to teach our surface fleet how to do anti-submarine warfare. They do have torpedoes, so we could use them in war if we want to, but that's not really our main goal. Whereas, obviously, in fact, what you're actually doing is teaching your U-boat crews very much how to fight surface ship fleets, as well as also, incidentally, giving a surface fleet anti-submarine experience. But the main point of it is that you're building up a very large cadre of U-boat-trained men, and then once war kicks off, or once tensions start to ratchet up, you can then go, look, we've got a working production line facility in place to block build submarines. We have a large cadre of experienced trained crews. We can now open the handles, if you like, crank up production of these U-boats very quickly and essentially flood the seas with large numbers of U-boats. And because they didn't exist before the war, building large numbers of escorts is going to be a somewhat less obvious thing for the British to do. And you kind of run it a little bit like the fighter pilots that the schools that the Allies did, where the initial wave of U-boats would be fully crewed by your expanded cadre of U-boat crewmen. But as they come back, you take those experienced crews offline and go, look, we're building so many submarines and we understand you'd like to stick together, but you've been really, really successful. We're going to split you up. Those of you who absolutely want to go back to sea can go back to sea as the nucleus of new crews. Some of you we're going to keep back and we're going to use you to train the next generation of U-boat crews who will go out with the next set of subs. And in the intermediate section, so cruisers and destroyers, I think as I've said before, I wouldn't bother with the German attempts to build massive super destroyers. I would actually focus on something like a slightly improved Elbing torpedo boat, which is basically a small destroyer, and go, look, this is a fairly capable unit. It's not quite as large as everybody else's really big destroyers, but honestly, if we build big destroyers, we're only going to have a few dozen at best, and any single loss is going to be really critical. Instead, we're going to start chaining out these smaller ships, which it's not going to necessarily approach the fleet numbers of something like a Royal Navy Marine Nationale team up, but locally could give you numerical superiority and a lot more ability to absorb losses. And also they look less threatening, so they're going to provoke fewer large destroyer construction schemes from the Allies as well anyway in the run-up to the war. And then finally with cruisers, this bit might be a little bit controversial. I would actually say that Germany is one of the very, very few cases in the 1930s where cruiser carriers might actually be justified. Not necessarily from a perspective of a straight-up fleet action. They'd still be hideously vulnerable there. But if you're going to have to go out and do commerce raiding, and you've inherited the Königsbergs from the Reichsmarine, they're definitely not suitable for the Atlantic. Something hipper hull-based, but that is a cruiser carrier, whether with two twin 8-inch forward or one twin 8-inch fore and one aft, but with a small dozen to two dozen air complement, might actually make the perfect surface raider for the North Atlantic, because it's high speed, so it can outrun most things, if not all things. It's got a degree of surface gunpowder, so if it gets into a convoy, it can actually cause fairly significant damage. That gunpowder is also enough to see off smaller escorts like corvettes, destroyers, potentially even smaller light cruisers, and for anything else, like larger cruisers or battleships escorting a convoy, that's what you've got your air group for. If you really, really want to get in and attack the convoy, you attack the heavy escorts with your aircraft. If you don't want to take any real damage to your ship at all, you also can attack the smaller escorts of the same convoy, or more likely escorted convoys, with your aircraft. Your aircraft also give you a great recon capability. And in the event that you manage to actually find a convoy with weak or no escorts and the convoy scatters, well, you can use your high-speed gun platform to chase down and engage some ships. Meanwhile, you can launch your aircraft to go off and chase down and cripple or destroy numerous other ships. And if, again, someone shows up with something like a battlecruiser or anything, you just hightail it. And so that's that. Yeah, as I say, it's not a good fleet unit for a battle line. Would make a very, very interesting surface raider, though. Orion Taylor asks, had war not broken out just yet in 1939, what was the Royal Navy's destroyer building agenda after the J, K, L, M, and N classes? Would an alternate history O, P, etc. classes have looked more like them, tribals with extra torpedo tubes, or something else, as opposed to war emergency flotillas, which were built historically? It's not entirely clear, actually, as there was a considerable amount of argument going on in 1938 and early 1939 within the Royal Navy as to what exactly the next generation of destroyers should be after the L class, the M and the N class being under discussion at the time, and then obviously what they're going to do moving forward. There were three essential lines of thought. And it depended which faction of the Navy you were in, which one you would support. One idea was to actually go very French style. So split the destroyer force into smaller, lighter, cheaper torpedo destroyers. So these ships would have 10 torpedo tubes, two quintuple launchers, and probably four guns, although it was accepted that if you were going to have four guns, it was probably better to have two twin mounts now instead of four singles. And then those would be complemented by much, much larger fleet destroyers, and these would be much more heavily gun-based. And the idea of that was essentially a tribal-like design, i.e. a four-twin gun design, but incorporating the advances both in gun design and hull design that had been made in the J's, K's, and L's. So they weren't entirely sure what that was going to look like and whether maybe they would go with a six-gun design to get another torpedo launchers back or not. There was quite a push for that. But they were also looking at, you know, well, there might be a new type of 4.7-inch gun. There might be dual-purpose 4.5s coming in. So the exact details of that weren't necessarily clear, but what that faction was looking for was a 2-to-1 ratio of small destroyers and large destroyers. Then there was a second faction that was looking at what they called the intermediate destroyer. So this would be kind of partway between the big Ks and Ls and tribals and the smaller interwar standard 4-gun ships. And a lot of that work looked at, again, having two twin mountings, but with a strong emphasis on night action and obviously radar still being a fairly new thing. There was also quite a high demand for a star shell gun. So instead of going with a 6-gun design, they went for, at first, a 4-gun design with two twin mounts up front, which might sound very familiar to those of you who are familiar with the weapon and battle classes. But they very quickly ended up putting one twin forward, one twin aft, a lot more light and medium anti-aircraft weaponry, which might be interesting to some people, but also then a single star shell gun, whether that be in the forward super firing position or somewhere amidships. It depended on the design option they were looking at. And this intermediate design kind of percolated through multiple different variants, but people kept coming back to, well, it's approximately the same size and displacement by the time all is said and done as the J-class, which were slightly smaller 6-gun destroyers prior to the Ks and Ls and eventually subsequently the Ms and the Ns. So if it is about the same size, well, it's a 5-gun design that's the same, roughly the same size, roughly the same cost. Why don't we just build more Js? Because then you get 6 guns... and we already have that design, so it'll be cheaper to do. And the third faction was a sort of a mild combination of either just jumping straight to that and going, okay, let's just build more J-class because they give us a nice balance between armament and size and cost and incorporate most of our more modern ways of thinking. But also that faction was mostly pointing at the J-class as a potential repeat, largely on cost grounds because people were freaking out about that a little bit. And realistically, a lot of them were looking at the Ks and the Ls and going, we'd actually rather just do a slightly improved version of those instead, but if we have to, we'll settle for repeat J-class. They did also look at a tribal that retained all 4 twin mounts plus 2 sets of torpedo launchers, but they decided that that would be far too long and unwieldy a vessel for a destroyer. And these arguments were still going on in early 1939, during which time they were being told repeatedly and more loudly, prepare an emergency flotilla design. We need to go to this. And essentially the arguments, still ongoing, just kind of die off as they switch over to producing the O and P class emergency flotillas. Captain Seafort asks, you mentioned that during the Age of Sail, ships usually only hoisted colours when they needed to identify themselves to avoid wear and tear, and to allow for potential ruses such as the one that Cochrane used. By the Second World War, though, as you mentioned in your final video on the British Pacific Fleet, the White Ensign flew continuously in wartime as long as a ship was at sea. When and why did the former practice die out, and the latter grow in its place? There are a number of factors involved, some based on practicality, some based on pride. A non-exclusive list of which would include things like the fact that, well, by the mid of the 19th century, the Royal Navy actually settled on having a single ensign, which was the White Ensign, whereas before you had the Blue Ensign, the Red Ensign and the White Ensign, and you might end up switching between them at various times. So you couldn't really say, well, we flew this ensign because, well, you might come under somebody else's command and have to swap ensigns out if you were trying to fly them continuously. Another perhaps slightly practical issue was the fact that, well, being steam vessels, they had to come into port on semi-regular basis, whereas in the 18th and early 19th century, if you're a sailing vessel, you could be at sea for months or even years, and there's only so many flags you can go through. Also, flags became a lot more easy and cheap to produce, which helped. But on a warship, steam warship at sea, there was a fairly high chance if you had a couple of dozen white ensigns on board in the late 19th century, it would be physically impossible for you to wear them all out before you got home or got to a friendly port where you'd need to refuel anyway, and you could pick up a bunch more. So it became possible to just essentially chain white ensigns along as each one wore out. Whereas if you were out for 3 or 4 years in the middle of nowhere, in the middle of the 18th century, you could run out, or even if you had 3 dozen ensigns aboard, you could run out pretty quickly if you kept flying them all the time. There was also the fact that as warship design in the 19th century began to diverge very heavily from merchant ship design in overall appearance at a distance as well as detail, you ended up with the fact of ruses, as in, you know, flying a different flag to pretend to be a different ship, became a lot harder to pull off, because warships built by certain nations had very distinctive profiles, and just flying somebody else's flag wasn't likely to fool many people, except in very rare circumstances where you're perhaps flying your flag and you're in a ship that had been built by another nation. Well, you might then at that point get away with it, but then that nation was probably your ally, so you didn't need to anyway. And particularly in the British Navy, there was also an element of pride that had come in, because even though the Royal Navy was fairly dominant during most of the Napoleonic Wars, it was still a knockdown, drag-out scrap for global dominance, and there were moments when the Franco-Spanish forces were of considerable threat, and so you had to be a little bit sneaky and a little bit covert about exactly who you were and what you were doing at times. Whereas during the Pax Britannica, the 19th century, as the Royal Navy grew to become and maintained its position as the largest and most powerful navy on the planet, there started to become more of an attitude of, well, why do we need to hide who we are? It doesn't matter if everybody knows who we are, because A, no one's going to mess with us, and B, if they're dumb enough to mess with us, they better, you know, well know exactly who they're messing with, because they're going to provoke an absolute storm coming down on their heads. And so actually it's kind of a weird peacekeeping thing, because yeah, don't mess with the white ensign, essentially. And if they are dumb enough to actually do so, then, well, we will obviously then proudly fly our flags and engage them with the reasonable confidence of victory. And if we don't win, then, well, the next 16 million ships that show up after us definitely will, and we won't disgrace them by having not shown our colours. And that attitude was kind of the one that was going into the 20th century. When, of course, obviously in the early 20th century, Britain still had the biggest and most powerful fleet around. Slow Pixie asks, following up from Drydock 404 Part 1, I found some data about the Swedish short cannon. While I couldn't find direct stats about them, I've been able to find the measurements for Russian short guns that were built on the Swedish pattern, and I've checked their weight against the weight of guns recovered from the wreck of the actual Crown Prince Gustav Adolf, which is the only data available online for the Swedish guns as far as I could find, and they match pretty much perfectly, so I think it's safe to assume these values are representative of the Swedish weapons. Having done the conversion from the Russian units of measure, it turns out that the short 24-pounder had a 5.95-inch bore, a length of 7.4 feet, 15 calibres, and a weight of 2 tonnes, and the short 36-pounder had a 6.81-inch bore, a length of 7.9 feet, 14 calibres, and a weight of 2.8 tonnes, which, if I'm not mistaken, would make these guns about 10-15% shorter than long guns of the same calibre. If this data is correct, does your conclusion in the previous answer that roughly a 30% loss in muzzle velocity and penetration compared to a long gun of the same poundage and the use of half charges still stand, or is there a gap in power smaller than that? Well, in my previous answer, I was relating from gunnery experiments that had looked at halving and doubling gun barrel length, as well as halving and doubling charges. So in this case, where we're looking at somewhat shorter guns, but certainly not half-length guns, we still don't have information on exactly what charges they'd be using, but assuming that they're using either the same or very slightly reduced charges compared to the average 24 or 36-pounder, the interesting thing is that 2 tonnes, the short 24-pounder, is almost exactly the same weight as a standard long 18. And at 2.8 tonnes and about 8 foot long, the short 36-pounder is, compared to the average 32-pounder of the period, just a fraction lighter and just a fraction and a little bit shorter, although there were some somewhat short 32-pounders, not absolute short, but shorter 32-pounders, which actually had a very similar gun barrel length and weight from the 1820s, 1830s. So given that you'd probably expect at least a similar, probably slightly larger charge in the short 36 that you're describing compared to the average 32-pounder, simply because, well, it is a somewhat larger gun, and a 10 to 15% overall reduction in length, that's probably going to give you a 5 to 10% loss in muzzle velocity, which when you plug it into a kinetic energy equation would mean that the short 36, because of that slight loss in muzzle velocity, and of course kinetic energy is mv squared, so the v, the velocity, is the much more important part of the equation, gives you about a 7 to 9% reduction in kinetic energy at the muzzle compared to a long 32. Now, given that we're talking about the upper end of naval artillery of the time, I don't expect that's going to make a huge difference to its penetration power, even at 1,000 yards, because, well, even at that kind of range, those heavy guns could and did punch through the hulls of certainly frigates and usually ships of the line. And, of course, then you'd also end up in the argument about energy retention of a heavier shot versus a lighter shot by the time it got out to that distance. But being a somewhat larger shot, when it does hit, it is going to punch a somewhat larger hole. It's going to displace somewhat more splinters, etc., etc. So, essentially, you'd be trading off a little bit of range and potentially at the extremes of range, some penetration power, in order to do a bit more damage. But at the 1,000 yards or so that you were talking about in the original question, I suspect the short 36 is probably going to be doing just a little bit more damage than a long 32, but it is going to be somewhat harder to aim because you're going to have to aim higher on account of that lower muzzle velocity. So you're going to have to fire it in a bit more of an arc. So your accuracy, especially on a moving ship, might suffer somewhat. The interesting thing is if you then apply similar ratios to the short 24 versus the long 18, you actually end up with near enough identical muzzle velocities, but obviously with the short 24 having a somewhat heavier shot, therefore potentially carrying a bit more energy, and probably actually therefore doing a bit more damage again when it reaches the other end of its flight. So whereas there might be some slight disadvantages to using the short 36 that you're swapping for somewhat greater damage potential, with the short 24, functionally, it's going to have similar ballistic performance to a long 18 and do slightly more damage at the other end when it hits something. The main disadvantage in that case would just be that obviously it's going to be somewhat quicker and less exhausting to load multiple rounds of 18-pounder shot as opposed to the heavier 24-pounder shot, just because it is heavier. The only big caveat hanging over that, of course, is charge size, which we still don't have data for, because in this case, I'm assuming similar or fractionally reduced charges to a standard 24 or 36 pounder, as opposed to, given that, you know, as those gunnery records say, in short barrel guns, you very often do reduce the charges. If they do have a somewhat reduced charge, you might end up with a slightly greater drop in muzzle velocity, which then may limit range and damage at extreme range. But you're still at the kind of medium ranges and shorter ranges where you'd expect most Baltic fighting to occur. The simple, larger nature of the shot would still do more damage, but you'd be at a disadvantage at longer distances. The Rogue Chief asks, not a naval history question, but a nautical engineering question. How do the traditionally designed Great Lakes freighters manage to last as long as they do? Such a long hull with a narrow beam looks like it should have more cases of shear breaks than they actually have, especially given the waters they operate in. Yet some vessels built before World War I managed to keep sailing during the space race days, and the Arthur M. Anderson alone was launched in 1952 and still sailing as of the time of this question, nearly 75 years later. While yes, a long, relatively lightly built freighter, compared to a warship obviously, with a fairly narrow beam isn't necessarily the world's most survivable design long term, There are some rather unique circumstances on the Great Lakes. In some ways, the Great Lakes are a bit like the Mediterranean. They're very nice and calm and placid, except when they aren't, and then they will absolutely do their level best to try and kill everything on or near them. And when it comes to the Great Lakes, those weather patterns are somewhat predictable, luckily, with weather forecasting, obviously mostly concentrated in the winter season, but also because the Great Lakes are very large in terms of just general geography, but in terms of freighters, the distances involved are relatively speaking short, because we're talking about voyages that can take days, as opposed to, obviously, in the open ocean, if you're trying to cross the Atlantic or the Pacific or something like that, you're talking about weeks. And that means that once you factor in loading, unloading and maintenance times, statistically, a Great Lakes freighter is somewhat less likely to encounter one of the vicious storms that, as compared to a freighter at sea. You know, whereas if you're 2 weeks into a voyage across the Atlantic and a storm blows up, you don't have any choice about whether or not you're going to have to ride through it. And of course, if the storm looks like it's going to be particularly vicious on the Great Lakes, you do just have the option of not sailing, because if it's only going to take you 12, 24, maximum maybe 36 hours to make the voyage, then given the fate of some Great Lakes freighters that have sailed through those storms, it's much better for everyone to just go, you know what, take half a day off, and when the worst of it's blown out, then we'll actually head out, and it's just better for everyone. So as a result, overall, unless you get caught in a really, really bad storm by luck or circumstance, the average Great Lakes freighter is not going to experience quite the same levels of extreme stress that an oceanic freighter regularly would. And therefore, less stress, therefore less wear and tear on the hull, therefore they would last longer. And as a corollary of that, if you do get stress-induced failures start to occur, again, if you're sailing across the Atlantic or the Pacific and you notice there's a crack developing in the hull, well, if you're a week or two away from port, there's not a huge amount you can do other than try and patch up, maybe alter how you're sailing a little bit, and hope, which means, of course, that any issues that do occur, generally speaking, are going to have time to work their way into the ship and cause more damage, seen or unseen, before they can be fixed. Whereas again, if you're on the Great Lakes and your sailing time is measured in hours or small numbers of days, if an issue does develop, there's a lot less chance for it to expand across the ship before it can get seen to. And in the absolute worst case, there will be places you can drop in to address the issue fairly quickly. So essentially, it comes down to the fact that yes, the design is more vulnerable to extreme stresses, but on average, the ships are much less likely to experience those extreme stresses compared to true oceanic freighters. And therefore, without those extreme stresses, the hulls will last as long as they were, you know, built quality-wise for. With the big caveat, of course, that if you do end up with some of these ships caught in the more extreme Great Lakes weather events, that can multiply up damage very, very quickly, which is why, yes, some of them sail for very long periods of time, others not so much. Dave Collier asks, the Royal Navy assigns badges and mottos to every ship, submarine, squadron and land base, but how are such assignments made? Who makes the suggestions for the designs and mottos, and who has the final say? It's something that's evolved quite considerably over time. So back in the age of sail, there wasn't really any need for such things because the ship was identified by the, you know, the big name on the back and the big figurehead on the front, and that was installed as the ship was being built and commissioned. But as figureheads started to die off during the 19th century, making up badges and mottos for ships was basically a bit of a free-for-all. The captain, and potentially if the captain chose to, the crew, could come up with near enough any design they wanted, any motto they wanted, on almost any shape they wanted, barring a few minor things that were generally accepted, like the crown with the ship and sails above and so forth. But it very much was a kind of an open season, and only if somebody did something particularly egregiously unacceptable would they be told to knock it off. However, as with most things, it became more and more regulated. So towards the end of the First World War, it the creation of ships' badges started to be a little bit more regulated, with specific shapes of the badges or coats of arms being assigned to different types of ships, and they would have to go through a degree of approval. Mottos, though, were still chosen by the ship's first commanding officer. And then you fast forward to the Second World War, and in the Second World War, there was a new set of regulations published, and that standardized the shape of a ship's badge or coat of arms to a circle, like you can see here for Invincible. And that's why when you look at World One, World War Two ships' crests, you can sometimes see diamond shapes, shield shapes, circular shapes, etc. Whereas you look at the more modern stuff, and as far as the Royal Navy's major surface combatants are concerned, they're all round. And the mottos as well, although technically still now chosen by the ship's commanding officer, had to go through considerably more approval. And then nowadays, at some point between the Second World War and the modern day, they've created a whole committee, because of course they have. And now pretty much everything is out of the hands of the ship's commanding officer and crew, and it's all decided by the committee, with also a caveat that, because obviously names tend to get reused, whereas before you might have a ship of a given name serving in the late 19th century, then another one of the same name in the First World War, and another one of the same name in the Second World War, and they might have three completely separate crests, three completely separate mottos, because it's all been chosen at the time by captain, crew, and later approved by committee. Nowadays, the most common procedure is to reuse the motto of the predecessor ship, and to a certain degree, sometimes also very heavily reuse the badge, or at least use very heavily influenced elements of the badge. Ark Dennis asks, what, if anything, did the Kaiserliche Marine do to support the German side of the World War I Western Front? If the rapid defeat of France via a massive right hook was so important to the plan to win the war overall, were there any plans to provide fire support to the last man on the right brushing the channel with his sleeve in the opening offensive? And how about after it all stagnated? Did they look at the British monitors and think, good idea, or anything like that? Not in those kinds of terms, no. Simply because when it became clear that you're going to face off against not just the Marine Nationale but the Royal Navy, the Kaiserliche Marine was very aware that plunging any substantial portion of its forces into the Channel or along the Channel coast to support the German army would result very quickly in either that force getting torpedoed and mined to pieces by whatever forces were in the Channel, or they get torpedoed and mined to pieces by the forces in the Channel and then cut off and destroyed by heavy capital units moving down from the North Sea. So it was quickly recognised that this would be pretty much suicidal, and whatever small amount of fire support they managed to offer briefly would be more than undone by the morale effect of having said forces blown out of the water by a very large and vengeful Allied surface force. And once the whole thing stagnated, well, the Germans still didn't have anything close to naval supremacy, so they couldn't really do things like the British could with monitors and shore bombardment. What they did do was formed of three primary elements that you could look at as directly supporting the Western Front. One of them was the use of cargo submarines, like you can see here, the Deutschland. And the aim of those was obviously to bring in high-value, low-volume strategic materials to allow for the continued manufacture of equipment, much of which would be sent to the Western Front. And in terms of more direct support, you had things like the Flanders flotilla, so the basing of destroyers, torpedo boats, and U-boats of a relatively short-range nature as close to the front as possible, not for direct fire support for the German troops, but to attack, sink, and hopefully deter the various supply ships that were ferrying men and equipment and supplies back and forth between Britain and France, on the basis, of course, that if you sink a ship with a bunch of troops on board, those troops can't get to the Western Front, and similarly with guns, ammunition, food, etc., it all diminishes Allied strength that's available on the Western Front. There just wasn't the time or the ships available to do direct fire support for the most part, though. You could also potentially look at the creation of some of the bigger rail guns, which used guns that were released by the German Navy to use either by or in conjunction with the army, but that's not really ship-based. ACC asks, Vikings were great raiders who used longships for quick strikes and withdrawals, but longships were rather small. While there was clearly room for food and precious metals, I've never wrapped my head around the logistics of how they transported human captives and larger stolen goods like livestock. Were they on deck in between the rowers? Did they underman their ships to save room for the return journey? The dimensions have never really added up for me. Well, it would be a combination of factors. The typical longship did get relatively broad amidships, round about where the mast was. So whereas if you were a forward end or aft end rower, you might not have a huge amount of space between you and the guy who was rowing the oar opposite to you. If you were an amidships rower, there would be a reasonable amount of space in between, which is obviously where you could place livestock or humans that you'd captured. The other thing is, of course, that although they don't have forecastles and stern castles in the way that later medieval cogs would do, the medium to larger longships would also typically have a kind of a half-height deck raised fore and aft, definitely aft, sometimes forward. And this would be kind of, well, aft it would be a command and steering position as much as anything else, and forward it would also be a fighting position, which it would also be aft in battle. And for obvious reasons, those areas would generally be kept clear, apart from whoever was in charge of the ship and the guy who was steering the ship. And so that would offer a bit more deck space for larger, you know, self-loading cargo, if you like, such as cows, sheep, chickens, and people. You would also, of course, have potentially taken some casualties while you were on your raid, and that might free up a bit more space as well. So you did have some room on longships to transport people and livestock. Not a huge amount of space, but enough for a reasonable number of such captives. And then multiply across by the fact that Viking longships rarely travelled alone, and suddenly your transport capacity will go up a fair bit. And factor in, of course, that it usually would only take a few days to travel between, say, the coast of Britain and either Denmark or Norway or wherever they were coming from. So you didn't have to worry too much about long-term comfort. It was just a case of, well, hey, yeah, you sit there for the next 24 to 48 hours and then we'll see what we do with you. Captain Oblivious asks, I was reading about the sinking of USS Liscombe Bay, and the article mentioned that in order for Japanese submarines to more easily locate the US fleet, a Japanese plane dropped a type of signal buoy that the subs could detect and lead them to said fleet. What principle did this work on? Radio, visual, sonic, etc.? And did other navies employ similar devices? So based on the reports at the time, from the destroyer USS Franks, which is the one that went off to investigate the beacon, what it appears to be is that this beacon was a strobing light, because they initially reported seeing a white flashing light similar to that which you'd see in the distress beacon of a life raft, which is why they went off to investigate it. The theory at the time, which the article seems to have run with, was that this was some kind of, you know, signal to tell Japanese submarines, hey, there's a ship, come over here and sink it. However, post-war analysis seems to have rather discounted that theory on the basis that obviously a submarine would have to be at periscope depth to see the beacon in the first place, and there's no auditory, you know, sonar ping or radio transmission which they could otherwise pick up to let them know it was there. And also, there didn't seem to be any kind of particularly dedicated or formalized coordination between the Japanese Navy submarine arm and aircraft in general, whether they were from the Navy or the Army. So the conclusion that most historians have reached, based on both the incident and other Japanese behavior elsewhere, was that the presence of the submarine was something more of fortunate luck for the Japanese, obviously bad luck for Liscombe Bay, and people conflated the presence of the beacon and the submarine and thought, oh, that must have attracted the submarine, where that doesn't actually appear to have happened. the flashing beacon rather seems to have been more of a way of telling other Japanese aircraft, hey, there, you know, especially in darkness, hey, there's a thing over here, come and attack it. Much of the same way as Japanese aircraft will drop signal flares at night to illuminate targets so that the ships that they were from could see and engage the whatever it was that that particular scouting aircraft had found. And the practice doesn't seem to have been particularly widespread even in amongst the Japanese forces, let alone anyone else, simply because most of the time ships tend to move. So if you're dropping some kind of marker, it has to be something that something can then follow up on pretty darn quickly. If even if you had some kind of pinging sonar marker or buoy, A, the chances are that your target will probably hear it as well. But B, even if a submarine is only an hour's sailing away, in that time, the ship will have moved on many, many miles away from where that beacon is. So it's basically pointless for those purposes. As a limited way of drawing in other aircraft, even then, other aircraft have to be in the area and you know, the target has to be relatively static. So if you're talking about ships patrolling off of an invasion beach, for example, or an area where an invasion is taking place, which is what Liscombe Bay was doing, then there is a certain benefit given that there would have been multiple Japanese aircraft in the area and they could have gone, oh, flashy beacon, right, let's go and attack whatever that is, because the response time would be in the order of minutes, which, you know, would serve to the target still going to be in roughly the same area. So as a result, it doesn't seem to be as a particularly widespread even amongst the Japanese, let alone anybody else, because that's very, very particular sets of circumstances. Yes, you would have Allied invasions off of, you know, Salerno, Sicily, Normandy, southern France, etc. But in those cases, you don't need a beacon to really tell where they are because they're right next to the land and you're not exactly too far away from them. So it's pretty easy to find them. This kind of thing only really applies, as I said, if you've got lots of aircraft patrolling at night and they need some kind of, hey, there's a target over here marker when they've flown from very long distances away and aren't particularly familiar with the immediate surrounding area. And that really only applies to a handful of situations in the Pacific War. And that brings us to an end for this week's Dry Dock. Thank you very much for listening, everyone, and I hope to see you again in another video soon. Bye for now.